Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Good morning. First District Congressman Rob Whitman joins us this morning. Congressman, good to have you here. Welcome.
Ted, it's great to be back. What a great day.
It's great to have you in studio for a full hour. It's been a long time, and we've got a lot to catch up on. I guess we start off with some of the big news with the president meeting with the North Korean president, and you just look at that and just even say those words, you just think, that's something that just even a few months ago we never could have imagined.
Yeah, you know, a lot of things have happened here over the past 6 months with the back and forth. But what I think is really intriguing about this is the president decided to go in a different policy direction. And the policy direction is putting maximum pressure on North Korea, engaging countries like China, talking with Xi Jinping, because China has a big role in North Korea's economy. So to get China to put pressure on them, obviously our allies of South Korea and Japan the same way. I think this has culminated in the South Korean dictator Kim Jong-un looking at the options that he has before him. I think he believes, too, that this president and our Secretary of Defense, who have adamantly stated that our policy includes the use of military force, that indeed both of them would decide to use that if negotiations for them to denuclearize didn't come to fruition. So I think it's intriguing to see that play out, and where Kim Jong-un, I think, has done the calculus and said, hey, listen, I better sit down and negotiate, because I do think that they'll use military power. And I think, too, from our standpoint, that it's critical that the expectation is that there'll be complete disarmament there, and that it be irreversible, that it be permanent, and that it be verifiable. All those things, I think, are critical in what the U.S. goes into this negotiation with. I was very positive this morning on the comments that are coming out of South Korea as far as the expectations. There's a whole team of experts there, so I think they're well prepared to get into the details of a deal. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who I serve with, who is just a tremendous individual. A lot of folks don't know this, but I was visiting West Point a couple of years ago, and there's a plaque on the wall of one of the buildings there that states all of the top graduates in each of the classes at West Point, and Mike Pompeo's name is on that list. So he's top graduate in his class at West Point, Harvard grad, just a really great guy, very, very thoughtful. And I think he laid it out this morning. He said, listen, we have done all the groundwork for this, and we do expect that there will be a substantive agreement that comes out of this. Now, I think it's going to be a long-term process, not only in the details of the agreement, but in my mind, the most important part of this, Ted, is that anything that is agreed upon as far as North Korea's denuclearization, you know, has to be verifiable, and it has to be irreversible. And we have to make sure that it is repeatedly verified. Because we've seen with the Kim regimes that they have not been trustworthy. And listen, I think it's absolutely critical we have these discussions, but I think also we have to go into this with a healthy amount of skepticism and say, you have to show us consistently that you're trustworthy and that you're going to do the things that you need to do, and that there's not things front-loaded in this deal. I mean, we saw with the Iran nuclear deal, we front-loaded all of that, and now you see Iran even more belligerent than ever. Hopefully, us backing out of the Iran deal has sent a signal to North Korea that that's not the way we're going to operate in how the Iran deal was put together, and that we're going to require that there's verifiable efforts that go on with denuclearizing their arsenal, and again, that it's verifiable and irreversible.
You've been over to the DMZ, haven't you?
I have, yes,
a number of times. So you know the dynamics over there, and just how I know things that I've read and heard, the South Korean people just live in fear of the North.
They do, especially in the region around the demilitarized zone. It's pretty amazing how life there transacts. There is indeed that fear. It's interesting, too, that there is also in South Korea a strong desire for reunification. Now, I know China doesn't want to see that because China sees a reunified Korea as a real threat to them. So from their standpoint, they kind of like a little bit of instability in North Korea. They like what happens there. I think, though, with the president putting lots of pressure on Xi Jinping, they can no longer stand by and be ambivalent about that. It would be, I think, a long-term process in order to get reunification going because the economy in North Korea is so non-existent. The economy in South Korea is so vibrant, you know, it would really be a drag on South Korean economy. So I still think that is a ways off. The interesting part of this, though, Ted, is that there's been a lot of mention of actually getting into a peace treaty. Remember, all we have right now is a ceasefire, and U.S. troops are in South Korea because all we have is a ceasefire. So some folks had said, well, let's enter into a peace treaty. And listen, I think we ought to be on the path to a more permanent agreement on peace. But again, remember, if you sign a peace treaty, the peace treaty would be the segue to removing U.S. troops in South Korea. And I think that would be premature until we are completely satisfied and that it's verified that North Korea has gotten rid of their nuclear weapon.
It's interesting when you said, you know, that there is a strong desire to, you know, maybe someday have unification over there. And I guess you kind of see that when a few weeks ago when the Olympics, when the two teams went together. And I think we all look, you know, in our Western way of thinking, look over there and think that there's no way that anybody would want that. But you see little pockets of that whenever there's just a little bit of hope that the South Koreans really grasp for that.
It is. There is. And as you know, when North Korea became into existence after the Korean War, there were families that were separated, and there's still those separations that are there. So culturally, South Koreans see themselves still culturally connected to North Koreans. So I think that will continue. You know, I have to give President Moon from South Korea a lot of credit. He's been pushing the issue, as you know, went to the DMZ to meet with Kim Jong-un. Mm. So they're doing everything, too, to try to push it in a positive direction. I think that they have a healthy amount of skepticism as to what Kim Jong-un will do. The same with President Abe in Japan. In fact, President Abe in Japan, in conversations with the United States, has been very adamant to make sure that the United States doesn't yield whatsoever in giving North Korea what they may demand unless there is certain and verifiable and irreversible results that are shown by the North Koreans indeed nuclearizing. So President Abe's been pretty much a hardliner on this. And President Moon, pretty much in the same realm. So I think there's a consensus among allies about how the president needs to go into this, what the shape of a deal would look like. As you know, too, I think members of Congress have weighed in and said, listen, we'd like to be part of this. The president wisely has said he would like for the Congress to ratify any sort of agreement that comes out of this, unlike the Iran nuclear deal, well, there was not ratification. So I think they're going about this the right way, with due diligence, with Congress, with our allies, and making sure that we get as broad an agreement on this as we can, which I think elevates the possibility for this to be a viable and sustainable long-term solution to the issues with North Korea.
And like you say, this is something we're going to see results from just be right away, no matter how positive this week goes with this, just like you say, just because of the verification.
Yeah,
part.
Exactly. And I think going in, there's all kinds of positives that these leaders are speaking. I think that's a good thing. And I think, too, that there's been some measured expectations about what the outcome is going to be. I think it'll be a process. I do believe that the multiple meetings that Secretary Pompeo has had with the North Koreans have laid down the groundwork for what would be at least in an initial agreement. I don't think that you're going to have a final agreement that comes out of this because I think there are a lot of different parts of it. You know, this evening, our time, Tuesday, Singapore time, you will have these two leaders will sit down and meet, and they'll probably meet with their translators for 2 or 3 hours, knowing President Trump and how he likes to continue the dialogue. It may even go longer than that. And then the teams from both countries will come together and begin to work through some of the details of the plan on at least what an agreement will look like. So I think they've got things, you know, well structured. There are lots of experts there. You know, it's been words to say, oh, you know, the U.S. isn't prepared for this. They're just kind of flying by the seat of their pants. I thought it was very good that Secretary Pompeo today got out there and said, look, here's our team. We have the scientists here. We have the experts on nuclear weapons. We have the military experts. We have people from top to bottom here to hash out the details of a plan, and that we are ready. And that's the reason Secretary Pompeo has had multiple meetings, not only with Kim Jong-un, but the deputy leader there, in putting the details of this together. So when you get there, you actually have a framework of what's going on. And, you know, give the administration credit too. They've been very quiet on what any of the details of this plan may include or what it may entail. And that's important because you don't want to, in any way, shape, or form, create expectations going in.
Yeah. First Sister Congressman Rob Whitman with us this morning. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
First District Congressman Rob Whitman here this morning. Lots to talk about. One of the things, Congressman Whitman, that you have talked about years, I think as long as I've known you, as long as you've been First District Congressman, whenever it comes around, especially this time of year and when there's not a budget, you've talked about the fact that this the summer recess is something that Congress used to do years ago because of no air conditioning.
Yes.
And you have talked for years and years about if there's not a budget, we shouldn't go home. It's kind of picked up. You know, a few more people have picked up on that, but you were one of the first that I remember talking about that.
Yeah, Ted, you know, I've been tremendously frustrated by the archaic practices in Washington. When I first got there, to me, it's all about getting the job done. And we are under time frames to get a budget done and appropriations bills done because the end of the fiscal year is the end of September. So if you don't get it done, then we end up with these continuing resolutions, which if you were to dream up a way not to run a business or government, you'd come up with a continuing resolution, which just kicks the can down the road, short-term spending continuations where you can't start anything new. You really can't make the tough decisions on what need to happen with appropriations bills. And I got very frustrated with those and just said, I'm not voting for any more CRs. And folks have said, well, Rob, you want to shut the government down? No, I don't. I actually want the government to operate effectively. When the Secretary of the Navy, just one small element of the United States government, when the Secretary of the Navy says that over the last 9 years of continuing resolutions, that has resulted in a waste of $4 billion for the United States Navy. That means putting $4 billion into a trash can and lighting it on fire. Those aren't my words. Those are the Secretary of the Navy's words. Then it ought to wake us all up. And I think members of Congress have to be the ones that suffer the consequences for inaction. August recess, as you pointed out, is an archaic practice of the past. It goes back to the days when there was no air conditioning, when members of Congress were farmers, when horse and buggy was the main means of transportation. Well, we got plenty of air conditioning. By the broadest of definitions, only about a dozen of 535 members of Congress are farmers. And we got plenty of jet aircraft, so no worries about horse and buggy transportation. We need to be in Washington until all 12 appropriations bills are done, because what happens is we end up back in Washington with about, you know, 13 or 14 legislating days left in the year. And then here we are, crisis management, threats of shutdowns, continuing resolutions, the worst way to manage a government. So luckily this year, it's getting a little more traction. I had a great conversation with the speaker to say, let's get this done. He said, Rob, I am on track. We're going to get all 12 appropriations bills done. I said, well, Mr. Speaker, here would be a good motivator for members is as a backdrop, as that safety measure, is let members know if we don't get all 12 appropriations bills done, you will stay in town until we get them done. So I've asked the speaker to do that. I have a bill in. I've been carrying this bill now for years that says stay on schedule. Don't get all 12 appropriations bills done by the end of July, then you don't get to go home. The good news is that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has actually canceled the August recess for the Senate.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
So he is keeping the Senate in town, which is great. The president's come out adamantly and said, I think Congress ought to stay in town until all 12 appropriations bills are done. It just makes sense because there's already a budget deal, so it's not like you're battling over a budget. You already have a top line, so you should be able to get these bills done and not have to worry about, again, another continuing resolution or shutdown. So I am hopeful this year that this actually gets done. I'd like to see it become a permanent fixture in the rules of the House and how the House operates, and that is, here's the scheduling, and members, you have complete control over how much time you get to spend back in your district in August. If you get your work done, you get to go back home, spend your time, vacation, do whatever you want. That's obviously up to the members. But if you don't, you're going to be here in Washington. To me, it's pretty simple and straightforward.
It's like dealing with little kids.
It is, yeah. It's just, you know, be accountable. Make sure that if you're not doing your job, then you suffer the consequences. That's the reality, Ted, in any other aspect of life. You know, anybody out there that runs a business, anybody out there that works for somebody else understands that there's that level of accountability that comes with the responsibility of the business or a job. The same thing ought to happen in Congress.
And I think that's what so many people look at Congress, among many things, and just get very frustrated at that. And I mean, you're one, you have the experience of running, being involved in local government and small business, and also state government that doesn't, you know, act like this.
Yeah, all the other elements require that a budget be done on time, requires that budget balances, and that's another whole thing we can get into, balancing a budget. But it requires that you practice the due diligence to do these things. And one of the reasons I think people like myself get very frustrated is that the process itself is broken. And I think if you fix the process, if you require Congress to do its job or suffer the consequences, I think you'd see a lot more action. And I think the public would be less frustrated with Congress because they'd at least see that there's a desire on behalf of the members of Congress to hold themselves accountable. And if they don't do the job, then they would actually themselves suffer the consequences. Now, Ted, if Congress doesn't get the job done, it's all pointing fingers. It's the Senate's fault. It's so-and-so's fault. It's this fault. It's that fault. And people look at it and go, you know, we really don't care whose fault it is. We want you to get the job done and get it done on time. So I think this cuts to, you know, the basic elements of expectations about what Congress needs to do, who needs to be held accountable, and what mechanisms should be in place to make that happen. And to me, no August recess would be a great motivator for members of Congress. And I tell folks, if you want to see some bipartisanship break out, tell people you're staying in town until the work gets done.
You mentioned balancing a budget. Realistically, how close are we to even getting close to something like that?
Well, I wish I could tell you that we were close. We're not in the realm where I think that we need to be. You know, the balanced budget amendment comes up from time to time, and it actually gets fewer votes. And I think that it should be a requirement of Congress. Now, obviously, you can have exceptions for national emergency and those kinds of things, but Ted, we can't continue down the road of where we are with the deficit. And, you know, I consistently have voted against continuing resolutions and against omnibus budget bills. Now, this past time, I did vote for this omnibus budget bill, but for the single reason that our United States military has atrophied so much and we have such a loss of readiness that I think that we were in a crisis situation. In fact, Secretary James Mattis, when he came in as secretary, was asked, what was the thing that astounded you the most when you came back to the Pentagon after being out of the military for 4 years? And his response was the loss of military readiness. And in fact, I was contemplating my vote. I had a great conversation, a call directly from Secretary Mattis, from General Kelly, the president's chief of staff. And we talked at length, and serving on the Armed Services Committee, I have that perspective. We spoke at length about the need to make sure we're resourcing our military to recover this lost readiness, because truly, in relation to the threats around the world, we are not where we needed to be. So for this instance, I voted for. There was a lot of other spending in there that I think is problematic. The good news, though, is last week, Ted, we actually did pass a bill rescission bill, which rescinded dollars that are either out there that are just sitting there, haven't been spent, mm-hmm. or have limitations to where they couldn't be spent. So we're gathering those dollars back in, about $15 billion, and putting them towards deficit reduction. Now, it's a little bit, but I think it's the right first step to say we're really going to be as strict as we can fiscally in relation to our other constitutional duties. Remember, you know, defending this nation, Article 1, Section 8 states clearly that, but we have to put that in perspective about what happens in the future. And you have to, I believe, not just restore military readiness that's been lost, but also restore fiscal discipline to get us on the track to reducing the deficit, getting to a point where the deficit's at zero, and then beginning to pay back this massive national debt. And another element that gets lost in that too, Ted, that we have to talk about is the autopilot spending programs, the areas of where there are problems with Social Security and Medicare. And the trustees tell us the challenges that we face, and those are things that we absolutely have to address. For every year we put that off, the solutions become more and more difficult. And that is, of our total obligations, that's the largest obligation that our federal budget has each year.
First District Congressman Rob Whitman here this morning. We will continue this when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's now 8:30.
I have the radio on. I'm listening to
Talk Done Right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
First District Congressman Rob Whitman here this morning covering a lot of different things. I want to have you talk a little bit more. You were talking about the military and just readiness. Because,
yes.
Boy, when I hear you talk, and whether you're here, you were just here on Memorial Day, and you talk Veterans Day, whenever you talk to military veterans, that's one of the things you focus on is just the readiness, just because we tend to forget that end of it. And I know you've traveled enough and been out in the field, mm-hmm. and with the troops, and you see what they deal with and what concerns them.
Yeah, Ted, it's, you know, to me, it's the most basic element of what we have to do for our nation's military. And as you've spoken, I've traveled not just around the First District, but around Virginia and around the world to the different places where our men and women are forward deployed. And the number one concern that I have, and the number one concern that's been expressed by those sailors, soldiers, Marines, and airmen, is readiness. And readiness is pretty simply this. Do our men and women in the military have the proper training? Is the equipment that they use properly maintained so that it can be properly operated? And are we modernizing to keep up with our adversaries? And unfortunately, I would say the answer to that question recently has been no. So now the challenge is how do we make sure we get training back up to where it needs to be? And that's not just training at the tactical level, and that is, you know, person on person, either with your systems or with your combat systems. Mm-hmm. But how do you then train at the level where our forces operate today, which is a joint operation? So, you know, when the Navy operates, it doesn't operate by itself. It operates in conjunction with the Marine Corps, the Air Force, the Army, and the same with the other branches. And if you don't train that way, if you find yourself in conflict, then what happens is mistakes are made, and then people aren't prepared, or they don't know what to do when they are operating in that environment. And you want to make sure that you place those soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen under the real-life stresses of what they would face if they were in a combat situation. You want to do that in a non-lethal realm so that they can learn and say, okay, learned this, learned that, didn't have to pay the consequences in loss of life for those lessons. You could do that in a non-lethal setting. And then if you ever found yourself in a wartime setting, you'd be prepared. So that to me is a critical element. We also have aging systems. You know, our United States Air Force is the oldest it's been in its entire history. Our fleet today is as small as it's been since World War I. All those things are very, very concerning. And our adversaries are
watching.
Yeah, and we're in the era of great power competition. You know, we have now for the past 17 years been involved in counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, which is essentially fighting those terrorist groups around the world. And we certainly needed to do that. But in doing that, we have taken our attention away from the growth of those major powers, the Russias, the Chinas, the North Koreas, the Irans, and what they are capable of doing. And we've allowed our capability to atrophy. And Ted, here's the bottom line. A strong United States military is the insurance policy for peace around the world. If you look at any other time through the history of civilization where there has been an imbalance between major powers, there has always, always been a conflict, because one major power look at it and go, hey, if we ever have a chance to assume dominance, now's our time to take advantage of a weakness in another great power. I don't want to see us in that particular situation. So rebuilding our nation's readiness, I think, is the greatest insurance to peace, and it's the greatest deterrence to bad actions by other countries like China, like Russia, who are developing their military capacity at a breakneck pace, building their navies, building great capability in their navies, developing weapon systems that require that our ships and systems stand off thousands of miles because they can now reach us at that distance. So what we're having to do is to respond to that and make sure that we can counter, that is, we can hold their military assets at risk too, to make sure they're not motivated to attack us, because again, that imbalance of power is what provokes, I think, conflict.
First District Congressman Rob Whitman here. We could talk, and we have talked in the past. You and I have talked military and world things. I talked the whole hour with you with that. But a couple things closer to home. I know rural broadband is something that, that you have worked on, and for a lot of people who don't understand the, I mean, you and the first district is just, I mean, you deal with around here. Broadband, we take it for granted, but you get to the northern neck, you get into King George, you get not too far from here, and you get into a lot of the rural parts of Virginia in the district, and it's a big issue.
It's a big deal, not just for our economies there, but for our students in the school systems to make sure that they can have that connection to technology. And Ted, as you pointed out, my efforts on broadband go all the way back to my days when I was on the Westmoreland County Board of Supervisors trying to get those companies in to get that high-speed access, not just for our companies, but for things like telehealth. You know, when you talk about shortage of physicians, one way to help with that is to have that digital connection to those specialists so people can get immediate specialized care when necessary through those telehealth portals. So, you know, we've done a lot with that through the years. The bottom line is this, is, you know, we still have a lot more to do. We still have to build out the infrastructure. We have to work with our carriers. In fact, we have a big event coming up at the end of June where we're asking all of the carriers to come in. That is the cable companies, the Verizons of the world, to tell us what are they doing with this system, or what's called a backbone, to where you can now transmit that data, that signal through that fiber optic network or through that cable network. And, you know, back last year, we met with the internet service providers, the ISPs. We actually had Chairman Pai, Arit Pai, who is the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, come down to listen to the concerns and things that the FCC can do to help rural areas with broadband. And there are a lot of areas that you're only going to be able to reach through wireless connectivity, through microwaves. And the newer technology now helps. It used to be microwaves were impeded by the moisture in tree leaves and geography. Then the newer microwave frequencies that are available now help overcome that. Yeah. So the technology is there for us to do that. So I want to make sure that we're finding every opportunity. The good news in the omnibus budget bill, there are about $600 million in there for unserved areas. And again, this is a change in policy. We want to make sure we're serving unserved areas, not underserved, but unserved areas. Let's get to the place where there is no broadband and bring it there, so that those folks can have that connectivity. You know, it always surprises me as I talk to folks across the district and I hear stories of parents having to put their children in the vehicle and travel to a place that has Wi-Fi.
Yeah, like the library or something.
Yeah, like the library or the McDonald's, whatever it may be, for them to have to travel there so their kids can do their homework. It's great, and the schools, you know, will get a grant to buy these tablets, and the students have tablets, but the tablets aren't the problem. It's the connections that are the problem. So we have to do more there. And we're looking at opportunities too, as we have a system that allows schools to be connected to high speed. Are there things that we can do to use schools as conduits in community to extend broadband out, you know, to citizens in those communities? So we've been working very aggressively with that. There's some good things going on, some good projects that are underway in the district. The Mattapani Indian Tribe is even looking at pursuing a project in the Middle Peninsula. So we're looking at every opportunity to be able to expand rural broadband. And in a lot of counties, you know, even near population centers, you just don't have the coverage that people think you would have. And we've got to do more.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, just driving to Westmoreland or you know, driving to the Northern Neck, or like you say, the Middle Peninsula, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of areas there that still, and just for, like, you talk about students, you talk about economic development and just the growth and just the what's available to people in these areas.
It is. The critical infrastructure for rural areas, Ted, is high-speed internet. You know, broadband in rural areas is the key to bring them up to the same economic opportunity level as our population centers. So to me, that has to be job one for us to get out and be able to do that. And as I said, there are successes out there. I'm not satisfied with the pace at which those things are happening, but there are successes out there, and I think we'll be able to do more. And I'm excited about the resources that'll be there to manage and to bring into the system these unserved areas throughout the district.
You still may have. Didn't you have a rural broadband? It was some kind of a commission or something that was looking at this.
We have a rural broadband advisory committee. We've held several summits. Okay. You know, we've done that with Chairman Pai. The next summit we're having is bringing in all of the carriers. You know, the folks, not the internet service providers, but the folks that have the infrastructure to actually bring the signal in and to create the system for high speed. We think that's critical, too. There's some good things going on there. We met with the Virginia telecommunications groups, the cable companies, and looked at what they are doing. I've met with the electric co-ops. Greg White at Northern Neck Electric Co-op is looking at an agreement, or trying to look at the opportunity for an agreement with several of the carriers and using their poles. You know, they have an extensive pole network there where they bring electricity to people. Again, under the old rural electrification efforts back in the early 1900s, now what they're looking at is, well, why don't we use that same system that's put in place as a conduit for broadband? And whether it's running wires or whether it's putting antennas on that, that's a great opportunity for us to do that. So we're encouraging anybody that has any sort of usable infrastructure. In fact, when I was in the General Assembly, I got a bill passed that said every state asset, and we have a lot of radio towers in the state that are public assets, that those public entities, whether it's the state police, the Virginia Game Commission, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, even local governments, have to work with wireless providers to look at antenna access, because we have to use every bit of our infrastructure to build this network for high-speed internet.
One of the reasons you're in the area today is that you're going to, later this morning, visit Eastern Virginia Career College in Spotsylvania. We'll talk about that when we come back. We'll wrap it up with First District Congressman Rob Whitman this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
First District Congressman Rob Whitman here this morning. You're going to be at Eastern Virginia Career College in Spotsylvania this morning to tour that facility. Those folks were in here almost a year ago, and really impressive program that they have there, as far as the type of training that they're giving students.
It is. It's absolutely phenomenal. And today, Ted, one of the areas that I think is critical for us to look at in our education system is to make sure that we are emphasizing or reemphasizing career and technical education. 60% of the jobs in the future will not require a four-year degree, but they will require certification or credential. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the jobs that are out there and where young folks can find a career path, and that is start as an apprentice, work their way to a journeyman, and then a master, and have a great job through a lifetime that continues to advance, continues to have them on the learning path, continues to increase their earning potential, these career and technical education jobs are really where things are happening. And those include elements of science, technology, engineering, and math. 85% of the jobs in the future will require some element of science, technology, engineering, and math. So I'm a firm believer that our school systems, beginning in elementary schools, need to start having conversations with parents and their children about where the jobs are and how the knowledge, skills, and abilities that they gain both in middle school, in high school, and then subsequently in a trade school or a career school or four-year college will result in them getting a job. 46% of college graduates today are not working in the area in which they received their degree. There's massive amounts of student debt out there. And we talk about how do we address the student debt issue? We address the student debt issue by making sure that students and their parents understand where the jobs are so that when they make the investment in education, wherever it may be, they have looked first about how that educational experience and the dollars they spend there will result in their children on their way to becoming adults have a job, a career path job, not just a job, but a career path job, and one that will continue to bring them up as far as earning potential and is a challenging and satisfying career. Those are things that have to happen, and you can't wait until our children are juniors in high school. You have to start that conversation in fourth and fifth grade, and there are more and more schools out there that are focusing on, you know, a highly technical path for these students to gain the knowledge, skills, and abilities to get those jobs. And, you know, Eastern Virginia Career College is one of a number of great institutions around here that do that. And we see more and more of that. You know, Germana Community College has their workforce development STEM training center there. Mm-hmm. So all of the groups are here looking at even our four-year universities, even the University of Mary Washington is now looking at that, especially in the allied health career fields. I mean, there are opportunities there for students to be able to get education at all of our institutions that result in that long-term learning and career development so that they can stay on a path to increase their earning potential and assume jobs with higher degrees of challenge and higher levels of earning. So I want to give credit to all of our schools here. University of Mary Washington, I've had some great meetings there with all of their staff, and they are just as devoted to this, as well as Germana Community College, Rappahannock Community College. You know, all of them are all in this element of workforce development, further education, making sure, too, they're looking outside of just the stock two-year and four-year degree programs. How do they meet the needs of students in all those different realms? And, you know, going today to Eastern Virginia Career College is another one of those institutions that is focused like a laser on getting these students what they need to be successful.
Well, and it also comes down to us as parents to have it's so much more now than just to say, like you say, at fourth and fifth grade, you got to get into college. You as a parent need to be aware of these kind of options.
And it's interesting, Ted, when parents actually go in and see the jobs that are available for their children, the jobs of the future, and see where their children would be working, what the jobs they would be doing, they're like, I didn't know this existed there. And once they learn about that, they're excited that their children could be in a job like that and have a long-term career path. So I think it's a matter not just of changing our curriculum in schools, but it's a matter of educating parents and make sure that parents early on understand that their children can be as successful in a career and technical education job as they can in a four-year degree job. And remember, too, you know, the amount of debt that somebody has to take on for a four-year college many times becomes as much of a challenge as the job market becomes for them. So this is a good way for parents to understand that and for parents to know that their children can be as successful in a career and technical education path as they can with a four-year degree.
I know there are a number of ways people can contact your office, and whether you've got a local office here, your Washington office, and then you're on social media, and lots of ways to get in touch with you.
Absolutely. Ted, we have an office up on 610 right next to the Doc Stone Center at Home Depot, so people can come by the office there. They can call us in Washington at 202-225-4261. They can go to the web and go to www.wittman, that's WITTMAN, www.house.gov, or you can just Google Rob Wittman. Again, that's W-I-T-T-M-A-N, spelled a little bit differently. Do that. You can engage us on email, send us an email. You can also sign up for a weekly e-newsletter. We have a great network of folks we send that to, and it gives you an update on what's going on in Washington. We also each week ask you a survey question, and it allows you to go into depth. So it's not just a yes or no answer. It's giving us an in-depth thought about what the issues of the day are and how you feel about that. And that helps inform the decisions that we make in Washington. So I urge folks to do that in any way, shape, or form to contact our office. All of our social media conduits, too, are on our website, whether it's our Facebook page, our Twitter, our Instagram. All those elements are there. So please connect with us on social media. We put a lot of information out there, as well as our website and through our weekly e-newsletters, to keep you informed and to engage you to get your thoughts and feedback. It's important, Ted, that this is a two-way street. It's great for us to push information out, but you know, our job isn't done until we get as many people's thoughts and ideas about what's happening in their thoughts as we make these tough decisions in Washington. So I just encourage folks to reach out to us and give us their thoughts and ideas.
You're one of the few congressmen who go back and forth, go home every night.
Yes.
And you stay in touch with all your neighbors.
I'm blessed to do that, Ted. You know, traveling back and forth every night, I can go by past people's homes I've known all my lifetime, and I can ask a question. Could I knock on their door tonight and tell them what I did today? And what would their response be? And I can envision this in my mind. Would they grab me by the ear and say, Rob, your dad taught you better than that?
Yeah.
Or would they say, good job? So it really gives kind of a measure of connection with reality and being able to do that.
You used to have a car that you took it had an incredible amount of miles, and it finally ran out. What are you driving these days?
Well, I'm still driving a little Toyota Corolla, which the one that had 415,000 miles on it, I finally had to retire. It was the same Corolla. So I'm staying with the same car, and they take me everywhere I need to go, and very, very, very economical car, and gets me to all the different places in the district.
I'm amazed at how you get around just around here, because the district goes from Hampton Roads to the Northern Neck to here, and you're here all the time. So it's good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here, Ted. It's important to be out there and talking to folks. So we always treasure that opportunity.
Again, that phone number, the D.C. phone number?
Sure, the D.C. phone number is 202-225-4261, or you can go to our website, www.wittman, that's WITTMAN.house.gov.
First District Congressman Rob Wittman. Rob, we will talk soon. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you, Ted.
That's it. We will see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.